Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What dangers do we set out on the dinner table each evening? Over the past few years, massive food recalls have become so common we hardly notice them until thousands are sickened and dozens killed by contaminated food. Writer and farmer Ben Hewitt wanted to understand whether the modern food production and distribution system is somehow more likely to spread disease or whether our bodies are somehow more vulnerable to foodborne pathogens. He discovered that the answer is a little of both, and he joins us to talk about why. Ben Hewitt's newest book is called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. Ben, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be with you.
I think for me in reading this book, the number one takeaway was really how much we don't know about food safety. Can we trust what we buy to eat?
Well, I mean, I guess the short answer to that is that I think there is always going to be an element of risk associated with anything we put into our body, whether we think of that risk as being, sort of the short-term acute potential of a foodborne illness via a pathogen, or sort of a more long-term risk relating to diet-related disease, which, you know, kills far, far, far more people annually than do bacterium like E. coli and Salmonella.
How did this all affect our grandparents and great-grandparents before the advent of things like modern refrigeration?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's a little bit difficult to answer because, of course, our technologies for tracking these outbreaks and for sort of understanding how these bacterium evolve and, how they insert themselves into our food is much more advanced than it was when our grandparents were, you know, kicking around the home canner over the stove on a hot July afternoon. But, you know, one thing that's really interesting is that, at least given the data that we have, it's really clear that the outbreaks have just simply gotten larger and larger. And I think, for instance, in the 1950s and 60s, you know, the big fear in regards to foodborne illness was botulism. And, mostly this was from canning. But the average outbreak affected two people, and so now we have, of course, outbreaks that are affecting, in some cases, literally tens of thousands of people.
And that's because back then those botulism outbreaks were not from a restaurant or from a plant somewhere, but probably from someone's kitchen.
Exactly. I mean, they were extremely localized. So if you were unfortunate enough to catch botulism in your food, you know, it was probably going to be yourself and your aunt who came over for dinner, and rather than having a situation where you've got one massive production facility and all of a sudden you have this food being distributed to in some cases literally millions of people from one facility.
It was also interesting to read about the difficulty in tracking solidly the numbers of people who get sick from their food every year. How do government officials try and keep track of this?
Well, there's a number of different ways. I mean, the CDC has monitoring programs, and the CDC is the agency, the Center for Disease Control is the agency that is responsible really for sort of tracking these. And they have, they rely really on public health departments, on a state by state, local, regional, state by state public health departments to sort of give them the information that they need. But it's a really, really difficult for them to track these outbreaks for a whole host of reasons. First of all, there is no sort of standardized methodology or standardized sort of protocol for states in terms of reporting these things to the CDC. So they're dealing with sort of very disparate protocols from different states. The other issue is simply the fact that our food supply chain is so, at this point, so long sort of and convoluted that sort of bringing, finding the source of any particular outbreak is just extraordinarily challenging. And, a perfect example of this is I think probably most of your listeners will remember the Salmonella outbreak last summer associated with eggs, mm-hmm. and it ended up sickening about 2,000 people. And the CDC first noticed a spike in Salmonella cases nationwide about 4 months prior to when they actually identified the source of that.
And, of course, the other problem is that a lot of people will get sick from these things but not be sick enough necessarily to go to the emergency room.
Yeah, and there's a whole other host of factors. I mean, you're exactly right. Some people may just have sort of an up. I mean, this is a whole other issue, but people, of course, respond to these contaminations differently. So just because two people ingest the same contaminated food doesn't mean they're going to respond in the same way. A lot of it has to do with how robust their immune system is. So some people may just get, a vaguely upset stomach and never think to report it. Other people may end up going to the doctor, often it will be misdiagnosed, or the proper testing won't be done to really determine if this is a bacterium that might have come out of food. So there's a whole real host of issues that go into making it really, really challenging for anyone to trace these with any certainty.
Well, and we've seen this happening almost in real time right now in Europe, where I think now they're looking at this most recent E. coli outbreak as being traced possibly to bean sprouts, but they weren't sure along the way. They've thrown away a lot of what turned out to be good food.
Yeah, and it was really sort of hard to watch that because for a period there of about 2 weeks, almost every day it was changing. We think it's in lettuce. Oh, we think it's in this, or we think it's in that, and we think it's bean sprouts. We think it's from this farm. No, we think it's from that one. Of course, they're doing the best work we can. I'm not trying to disparage their efforts, but it does sort of point to the inherent challenges of having such a complex and far-reaching supply chain. And of course, in the meantime, as was the case in Europe, the death toll is sort of mounting every day, and no one really knows, what foods should we be avoiding? It's just simply not known.
And then it's also hard to know, Ben, what to do with the food once you get it home. So let's just talk about produce, fruits and vegetables. Most people will wash this stuff off before they put it in their mouths, but that doesn't necessarily eliminate what's bad for us.
It absolutely does not. And, unfortunately, this is the reality. And while the food industry would very much like you to think that the consumer is pretty much entirely responsible for treating and preparing this food in a way that's going to eliminate all the risk, the reality is that's sometimes very difficult to do. And one of the sort of tragic ironies, I think, of foodborne pathogens is that often the food that we can think of as being most healthy for us, so eat your vegetables, raw fruits and vegetables, which we all know we should be eating more of, are sometimes the ones that are most prone to sort of carrying this stuff, in part because they haven't been processed. So, most processing results in sort of some sort of heat application, which can often, kill off these bacterium. But, of course, the flip side of that is the reality that eating a lot of processed food is, in the long run, probably much more likely to kill you than the relatively small chance of catching E. coli or salmonella or whatever it is on unwashed spinach.
So let's talk about E. coli, because this
Sure.
is one of the things that people really worry about. And there are actually a number of major strains. Talk about how they differ from one another.
Yeah, well, E. coli, I mean, there are actually over 700 strains of E. coli, and most of those, and not just most, I mean, the overwhelming majority of those, let's just round it off and say there are 700, about 695 of those are perfectly harmless. And, people are sometimes shocked. I was actually shocked when I found out that, I'm populated by E. coli right now, just as you are. We all harbor E. coli in our systems. It's just that we're harboring, variants of E. coli that aren't just actually harmless, but are actually beneficial to our health. Mm-hmm. So, when you hear the term or the word E. coli, I think, people sort of, their alarm bells go off. But the reality is it's only a couple of strains of E. coli that are actually have the potential to really make you sick. And the ones that do can make you very, very sick. It's why I think E. coli, even though it relative to other foodborne contaminants, doesn't really cause that many deaths. Because when people do get sick from it, it's very dramatic and makes people extraordinarily sick and can kill them in a very horrible way. It seems to have become sort of the poster child of the foodborne contaminants.
This was the pathogen that was behind the Jack in the Box outbreaks
right.
About 15 years ago.
That's correct. And yeah, in 1993, the Jack in the Box, which was the first, E. coli had been identified prior than that as being responsible for foodborne illness, but this was the first sort of large-scale foodborne illness outbreak involving E. coli 0157H7, which is the variant that's most likely to be the one that's going to make you sick. It's the most common, I guess, of the ones you really don't want to have anything to do with. And this was the first one that really brought this issue to, I think, the public consciousness. And that was for a number of reasons. You know, one, it was sort of sort of a sweet spot, I guess, in the consolidation of our food system. It was also at a time when the technologies were being better able to identify these bacterium, and it was also at a time when the media was sort of primed to pick up on a story like this. So it really if you want to try to sort of identify a point at which Americans' public consciousness really coalesced around the issue of foodborne pathogens, I think that would be exactly the point.
I remember reading some accounts of that around the time it happened. It was long before I had kids myself, but to this day, I don't give them any kind of hamburger meat because it just freaks me out.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that I think that is really worth mentioning, and I think your response is really common. You know, one of the things that's happened is that the way we eat hamburger, for instance, has changed so dramatically in the past three or four decades. And so, you know, you might think of a hamburger as being something where you go to your butcher and he, breaks off a chunk of chuck roast and puts it through a grinder, and there's your hamburger. But that's, you know, for most people eating burgers either at a fast food chain or buying, you know, burgers from preformed frozen burgers from a store, that's really not the way hamburgers are made. And, you know, the modern hamburger is very likely to have bits of flesh from dozens, if not more, animals in it. And it's also very likely to not be purely beef. It's likely to have other fillers in it, that all of which carry the risk of contamination. And so when you have, you know, when you have 20 or 30 or 40 animals represented in one burger, all it takes is for one of those animals to have been contaminated and to have sort of allowed that bacterium to catch a ride, and all of a sudden now this whole batch of burger is contaminated.
So, Ben, if E. coli resides only in, we'll be delicate here because it is lunchtime in Dallas and Fort Worth, only in the parts of the animal that we do not eat, how does it find its way into ground beef or anything else that we would eat?
Right. Well, this is going to be very hard to talk about without at least introducing the term fecal matter.
We'll go there, but no further.
My apologies to any of your listeners who are eating particularly beef right now. But, you know, the reality is the conditions on the modern high-density feedlot confinement animal operation are such that the animals are, you know, in pretty much constant contact with their own feces and, of course, the feces from all the animals that are around them, which can number well into the thousands. And the speed with which these animals are dispatched. So in a modern slaughterhouse, you know, you're talking about an animal a minute. These things go very, very quickly. And it's, you know, despite the fact that these would be considered, federally inspected slaughterhouses, with all of the sort of modern technological standards, the reality is that they is not very difficult for this stuff to catch a ride on any particular carcass. Hmm. And so the unfortunate sort of offshoot of that is that if you're eating hamburger these days that comes out of one of these sort of feedlot operations, you're not just eating hamburger, and I guess I'll just leave it at that.
My guest is farmer and writer Ben Hewitt. His newest book is called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is farmer and writer Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. If you want to be part of the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Ben, let's turn this upside down for a minute and answer this question. Why, given the risks, do we not get sick every time we eat many of the foods we've been discussing?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that although these outbreaks have really captured a lot of, front page media attention, the reality is that, by and large, our food system, at least in regards to what I sort of term short-term acute foodborne illness, to sort of differentiate that from the long-term foodborne illness, diet-related foodborne illness that is, killing an awful lot of people. But by and large, your chances of getting sick from E. coli or Salmonella or Listeria or any of these is really, really slim. There has been a lot of sort of drama, and one of the things I think is that lends this whole story some drama is the reality that these bacterium tend to sort of prey on people who are weaker, and often those people are kids because their immune systems are less fully developed. Hmm. And so I think, that really sort of strikes a chord with people and really sort of instills a degree of fear.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Chris in Arlington. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to ask your guest, my son was 11, and now he's 22, I might add, when he became sick, very sick, and it took us 3 trips to Cook's Children's Hospital before they realized it was E. coli. And then recently I read that, and Cook's saved them. Great hospital, let me tell you. He lost a third of his body weight before it was over.
Mm. Poor kid.
But the question was, I read an article that said that later in life, he may have some residual health problems due to that E. coli poisoning as a child, that he had in childhood.
Do you know anything about that, Ben?
Yeah, I don't know the real. I'm not a medical professional, but I do know that the long-term implications of E. coli poisoning, it can often do long-term damage to the kidneys. So that he may be totally out of the woods and may very well be fine, but there is also at least some chance that he will have kidney issues going forward or possibly other effects. These bacterium are rather devious, and what we understand about them. You talk to any sort of microbiologist. And they'll tell you that we know, only a handful of percent of what there really is to know about these bacterium and how they affect our bodies.
So, Ben, I think for at least a percentage of people listening to this conversation, the response might be to say we need to regulate more heavily, we need to sterilize the food we eat. But in fact, you found that there can be some negative consequences even to our best efforts to make everything perfectly safe.
Well, yeah, and here you get into, what really sort of, for me, became sort of the crux of this story and what I became, personally sort of most intrigued by, which is this whole issue of the interplay between the human body and bacteria. What's happening right now, I think, is that we have a little bit of this issue of sort of, I call it sort of culture in a bubble. And so we need to understand that it's really important, and there's actually a whole host of research going on right now regarding bacteria in humans. For instance, recently we've discovered that there are about 10 bacterial cells in your body for every human cell. So, Chris, you're actually more them than you are you. I don't know how comforting that might be, but the less diverse that the microbiota is a term for a community of bacteria. The less diverse the microbiota of your body is, the more susceptible you are to foodborne illness or, you know, any illness relating to bacteria. Because what happens is that you don't have a really sort of vibrant, competitive environment. So when those salmonella bacteria sort of enter into your body, if you don't have that vibrant, diverse, competitive environment, they're much more able to sort of replicate and sort of, you know, take charge of things, so to speak. And that's when you get sick. And so, you know, one of the sort of conundrums of all this is that the more we try to sterilize, the more we sort of back ourselves into a corner. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we're in this spot now, in some cases, I think, where you know, some biologists, microbiologists believe that, you know, we've really been thinking about this in a very sort of short-term way, which is like, okay, we've got to sort of outrun these bad bacteria. But, of course, the bacteria are always evolving. I mean, there's no such thing as good and bad bacteria. That's a sort of human-assigned dichotomy. I mean, the bacteria just are. They exist, and they evolve, and they change. And so as we try to thwart them, you know, an analogy might be what's going on in some cases with antibiotics right now, where antibiotics and the bacteria that, you know, antibiotics used to treat not so long ago are evolving away and in a direction where we can, in some cases, no longer treat them. And so as we sort of sterilize more, as we disallow ourselves as humans, you know, with our very enormous bacterial populations, if we disallow ourselves to evolve with these bacteria, we actually put ourselves in at a greater degree of risk in the long term.
Well, I was surprised to read that people who had recently been treated with antibiotics for unrelated medical conditions turn out to be more susceptible to salmonella infection.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And, you know, we think of antibiotics as being a lifesaver, and they absolutely are. I'm not here to talk down antibiotics at all, although I would certainly be an advocate for very responsible and considered antibiotic use. But, you know, the term antibiotic actually literally means against life. And what do antibiotics do? Well, they go into your system and they kill bacteria. And they can be, you know, somewhat targeted to kill certain types of bacteria. But the reality is they don't just kill the bacteria that's making you sick. They also kill some of that, you know, other populations of your microbiota. So they're killing other species of bacteria in your gut, which are keeping you healthy. And so when you go in and you sort of, you know, carpet bomb your gut with antibiotics and you sort of wipe out a lot of these health-giving bacteria, beneficial bacteria, then again, you become more susceptible.
What kind of foods give us good bacteria?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the ones that people are catching on to, I think, recently, and even the food industry is catching on to, if you see, anytime you see the food industry start advertising health benefits, you know they're starting to catch on to something, and that's yogurt. So people might be familiar with the term probiotics, and so these are really beneficial bacteria. So yogurt is full of beneficial bacteria because yogurt is, in general, you know, it's a fermented food product. Certain cheeses, particularly raw milk cheeses that have been aged, you know, past the FDA mandated 60 days, so they're perfectly safe. But they're built on all of this beneficial bacteria. That's what allows them to sort of ferment in this way that is perfectly safe. So in general, the word might be fermented food. These are foods that are just teeming with beneficial bacteria.
Okay, so you raised this catchphrase that really gets people thinking, and that's raw milk.
Right.
Talk a little bit about what you've learned. And we should say that you raise some dairy cattle on your farm.
That's right. We raise dairy cattle. We live in a dairy farming community, and we, along with almost every dairy farmer I know, drink raw milk straight from our cows. I do not present myself as a raw milk advocate. I think it's an issue that people need to take very seriously and do their own research and you know, decide whether or not it's right for them. But the raw milk community, fervently, for the most part, believes that raw milk is teeming with these beneficial bacteria and enzymes, and it's one of the reasons that raw milk has become, sort of one of the hottest, you know, black market foods across the U.S., because, of course, it's illegal to trade in raw milk in about half the states in the union.
And let's talk about the history of this, though. Before, pre-World War II, literally one in four foodborne illnesses could be traced back to raw milk.
Yeah, so raw milk, you know, and of course, and back in the day, it wasn't called raw milk because there was no such thing as pasteurized
milk.
So, you know, milk, first of all, milk is a wonderful vector for bacteria, be they the type of bacteria that can make you sick or the type of bacteria that can make you well mm-hmm. and keep you well. It's warm, it's moist, you know, bacteria just love it. And, of course, you can't clean it the way you can, you know, the way you can, say, you know, lettuce that you can wash or something that you can, you can't wash milk, right? And most people don't cook milk. Of course, if it's pasteurized milk, it's been cooked for you. But the point is, it's a very sort of convenient vector for bacteria. And, you know, prior to pasteurization, you know, milk was, you know, by far the most common source of foodborne illness. And one of the reasons, though, I think it's really important to point out that the cleanliness standards on the dairies of that era were just horrid. And so these were known mostly as swill dairies. Mm-hmm. And the dairies were often located in urban centers. And they were, for convenience's sake, typically located right next to a distillery so that the animals could be fed on the waste distillery mash. Mm-hmm. And the animals had no access to pasture. They were basically corralled, much like a modern feedlot operation, you know, knee-deep in their own effluent and fed distillery mash. And so, and the sanitation was just, you know, absolutely off the charts awful. And so there was an awful lot of sickness. So there's no question in my mind that pasteurization, you know, given that as sort of a context for how our milk was being produced, pasteurization was an enormous human health benefit, no question. But there is, to me, it seems, some question as to whether or not the long-term effects of pasteurization have been, you know, to sort of deprive us of some of this beneficial bacteria that really is, you know, responsible for keeping our systems in check and tuned up and diverse. And the reality is that most people today who are producing raw milk are producing it to a much higher cleanliness standard. There is one issue, I think, which is that the demand for raw milk has been growing so fast that I think a lot of farms that are producing milk intended for pasteurization, which is to say they know the milk they're producing is going to get cooked, basically sterilized, are now starting to sell this milk off the farm. And because they know that this milk is going to get sterilized, they're not really producing or paying enough attention to the cleanliness aspect. And I think that's a real hazard. I think I would be remiss not to point out, though, that according to the FDA's own data, deli meats are about 10 times more likely to give someone foodborne illness on a per-serving basis than raw milk. So there are even though raw milk gets a lot of media attention for being, you know, a vector for these things, it's actually not by far one of the most dangerous foods you can consume.
Does raw milk taste different?
You know, yeah, I would say, although it's been so long since I've drunk pasteurized milk, it would almost be hard for me to answer that question. I know my kids who will be offered pasteurized milk at friends' houses won't drink it. Mm-hmm. You know, they just feel like it doesn't have any sort of body and flavor to it. They've become so accustomed to fresh milk. So I guess the short answer is yes. The longer answer is yes, I think so, but I don't really know how to describe it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Gabriella in Dallas. Hi, Gabriella.
Hello. A couple of points. The first was the discussion about E. coli and something that your gentleman didn't mention is the historical basis of that. That was directly after the Reagan administration did some serious, serious cutbacks as to the budgets for inspections, especially USDA. And so what ends up happening when things aren't inspected is things get lax. And it was that lack of inspections, which is clearly documented in the history of that particular E. coli case, that lack of inspections because of cutbacks, because the few inspectors suddenly had considerably more plants to inspect. That was one of the reasons that that happened.
Well, and this is something, the inspection dearth is something that you do address in the book, Ben.
Yeah, it's correct. I mean, currently the FDA inspects a given facility about once every 7 years. And, you know, about 1 to 2% of our food imports, which is, you know, increasingly the food we import is an increasingly large percentage of the food we consume. About 1 to 2% is actually inspected. So your caller is exactly correct. I mean, there is not a lot of inspection, and therefore very, very little accountability in our food system.
What impression did you get from people who are producing this food? You know, we have a tendency sometimes to talk about, you know, big corporate America doesn't care if people get sick. If for no other reason than it's really bad for business to make a bunch of people sick, it would seem like they've got a vested interest in providing a safe product.
I think you're right, and I think that on one level they absolutely have an interest and care. But I also think that there has been historically, and when I say historically, I guess I'm probably talking, you know, over the last 50 years or so, a certain sort of laissez-faire attitude and a more sort of calculating approach, which is that, you know, they realize that it's very difficult to sort of reach true accountability and certainty with these cases. And so they know that the chances of ever getting caught, you know, red-handed, so to speak, are really, really slim. Hmm. And so they, you know, I think there is a certain amount of calculation regarding, okay, what are the chances, what risks can we reasonably take, and what, you know, versus what are the chances of us actually getting caught and really getting in trouble? And so we have to realize that out of all the cases of foodborne illness, you know, very few actually end up in litigation and with a favorable settlement. So I mean favorable to the plaintiff. So there, you know, they know that there is little accountability.
You did meet with, I guess, the number one foodborne illness litigator in the country.
Yeah, Bill Marler. Yeah.
Talk about him and his sort of approach to this whole thing.
Yeah, Bill is this wonderful character. I mean, as soon as I started sort of reporting this book, his name just started popping up everywhere, and everyone's telling me, hey, you got to talk to Bill Marler, and Bill Marler, he's the man, and you got to talk to him. He's all over the place, and Bill was the guy who successfully litigated the Jack in the Box cases. He really made his name with the Jack in the Box case and decided sort of after that to really focus on foodborne illness. Now, you know, the cynic might say, well, you know, he's no fool. I mean, it's like when you are dealing with foodborne illness outbreaks, you're dealing with outbreaks. And so, you know, for every outbreak, he has the opportunity to take on dozens and sometimes literally hundreds of clients. And so his firm has done extraordinarily well, sadly enough, because there have been enough outbreaks. The thing I really find intriguing about Bill, though, is one of the things I found intriguing is that he is just as apt to go after a small-scale producer of raw milk as he is, you know, ConAgra or one of the large corporations.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break.
Sure.
My guest is farmer and writer Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Making Supper Safe. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is farmer and writer Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. You were mentioning, Ben, before the break, Bill Marler, and saying that he goes after both large and small food producers alike. Does his presence on the landscape and that of others like him help to keep producers honest, if that's the right word?
I think that's true. I do think that's true. I mean, Bill, you know, most of the people who are sort of on the side of, you know, in the raw milk crowd, for instance, Bill calls them the raw milkers, you know, think he's sort of the devil incarnate because he's, you know, he's really willing to press his case no matter, you know, sort of where it's going. And then sometimes that, you know, that finds him you know, going up against the raw milk people and as they see it sort of impeding on food rights. And, you know, to a certain extent, I understand that. But he's also been really responsible, I think, in some cases for keeping, you know, the large-scale producers on their toes. And so, you know, I think in the book I called him an indiscriminate thorn in the side of food producers, large and small. But one of the things I think, I sort of appreciate about Bill is that even though he really focuses on this issue of you know, pathogenic bacteria, you know, he sees it as something that he can focus on and within his power and scope. He also really understands that you know, the only way we're really going to get out of this mess is if we sort of regionalize food systems. I mean, we really need to move away from this mass production model where these, you know, these, most of these huge outbreaks or all of these huge outbreaks are originating.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Matt on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I was curious about kombucha teas. I see them in Whole Foods, and I even go to some yoga studios where they have homemade kombucha. And I'm curious if you think that's safe and has good stuff in it.
Yeah, kombucha. I mean, we actually brew kombucha here at home, and it's so kombucha is a sort of fermented tea that's made from a bacterium. It's called the mother, and looks just disgusting. It looks like I don't really know. It looks like some kind of like silicone floating lily pad or something. And you brew tea and add sugar, and the yeast in the bacteria sort of feeds off the sugar. And makes this fermented drink. It's Russian origin. And the thing to understand about something like kombucha is that these bacteria can't survive in highly acidic environments. And so kombucha, when it's actually a finished product, is highly acidic. And this is why the FDA has that 60-day mandate on raw milk cheese, because actually this is a really interesting concept, but the older, in a sense, the older a cheese gets or the older a fermented food gets, the safer it gets, because it's becoming more and more acidic. Its pH is getting lower and lower, and these bacteria can't survive in those environments.
What about like a nice glass of wine with dinner? Does that offer any protection?
Not that I'm aware of, although, you know, when I asked Bill Marler what he does to protect himself against foodborne illness, he says, I drink a lot of scotch. but I'm pretty sure he was just joking. I'm not sure that there's a biological, you know, reasoning for that. So, you know, the human gut is very acidic, and that is one of our sort of protective mechanisms. It's one of the reasons that we aren't getting sick from this stuff more often. But some of these bacteria, and particularly E. coli 0157H7, have become more resistant to those acidic environments over time. But still, with something like a kombucha or these raw milk cheeses, you know, these are typically, you know, sort of past the point of survivability for these bacteria.
What effect does monoculture farming have on the safety of the food supply?
Oh, that's a great question, and you're sort of getting at, you know, another sort of, I guess, heart of my argument, which is that the way we've come to think of food safety in this country has become, I think, sort of overly and maybe even myopically focused on the issue of pathogenic bacteria, which is to say, you know, pathogenic bacteria, I don't deny that there are tragic outbreaks and that there are, you know, preventable deaths happening in this country. But the reality is that they're probably responsible, you know, if the CDC's numbers are to be believed. And another interesting point is that the CDC actually just recently cut its estimates almost in half for the number of people being affected by these, which is, I found just fascinating, given that these outbreaks are just getting larger and larger. Mm-hmm. But pathogenic bacteria are responsible for about 3,000 deaths a year, 3,000 very tragic deaths. But according to the Harvard School of Public Health, diet-related disease is responsible for over 1 million deaths a year. And so monoculture farming, I would say, has done more to sort of perpetrate human suffering because it has sort of led us to a food system that's overly dependent on these cereal crops and high fructose corn syrup and these many ingredients that are very, very well linked to long-term diet-related death and disease. So I would say, you know, if you really want to talk about food safety and making our food safe, you really need to start talking about, you know, what are the just the base ingredients here that are making us so sick in this country?
Things like corn and soy?
Yes, corn and soy, and, you know, in particular, high fructose corn syrup, these really highly refined products that have been linked to obesity and diabetes.
Have you seen the new ads where the high fructose corn syrup industry is sort of coming back and saying,
yeah,
your body can't tell the difference?
That's right. Yeah, your body can't. But there are just, you know, they would really like you to believe that. They're even trying to rename it corn sugar rather than corn syrup because it has gotten such a bad name. But, you know, unfortunately, there are just too many independent studies that really show a very, very high correlation between this type of sweetener and these type of processed products and this kind of diet-related disease. there's also studies out there that are showing that about 50% of the high fructose corn syrup products out there on the market today are contaminated with mercury because in the process of manufacturing high fructose corn syrup, there is exposure to mercury.
Wow. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Frisco. We'll speak with Paul out there. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing? This, you know, listening to the show today reminded me when I was a kid growing up in Kansas, and it's not really health or safety related, but there was a large contingent of Mennonites, and they were wheat farmers and dairy farmers, and we used to go out and buy milk directly from these people. They had automatic milkers, but they didn't have any pasteurization. It was in a big stainless steel container. But we'd get these mayonnaise jars you get from a restaurant and get about four or five of those. I think it was 25 cents a gallon. And we'd fill this thing up and take it home, and that's how my mother gave us all milk. And it was very, very rich, I remember. You let it sit in a refrigerator overnight, and the cream would rise to the top. It'd be about 4 inches thick. But, I mean, it was rich milk. And the observation earlier was that his children didn't drink packaged milk. And same with us. When we'd go and drink pasteurized milk at a friend's house, it was like drinking water because the stuff we got directly from the dairy was so rich. And, hey, I drink buckets of this stuff, and I'm okay. So I guess I got lucky.
Well, we're glad that you're doing well, Paul. Thanks for your call. Ben, do we have to sort of, people who want to explore having food that is less pasteurized or not pasteurized, do they need to sort of build their bodies up to accepting this food?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I think there may be some truth to that. I have noticed, you know, very anecdotally that, you know, it seems to me every time you read about an outbreak associated with raw milk or someone getting sick associated with raw milk, and I'm using raw milk as the example here, not because I want to keep harping on that, but because it is what people seem to be noticing an awful lot, that, you know, it's very often someone who's just started drinking it. And so what I do think there's some truth to that. I think people need to be very, very careful and aware where this stuff comes from. And I guess, you know, I'm a big advocate for sort of personal responsibility in regards to our food consumption and for us becoming, you know, not just food consumers, but actual sort of participants in our food. I mean, I think we forget what a recent phenomenon it is for us to just sort of assume that we can, you know, there should be no risk associated with eating or that we don't have to have anything to do with feeding ourselves. And I think, you know, if we really want to get back to a place where we're talking about, you know, sort of food safety on a more holistic level, that it's not going to happen unless people start sort of becoming much more engaged. And so, you know, I do advocate for people who are interested in sort of exploring this first to do a ton of research. There's a lot of really good information out there. There's probably some bad information out there, too. But, you know, to really go into this, you know, eyes wide open and recognize that, you know, there are going to be some risks associated. I think, you know, if we want to move away from this sort of long-term, you know, cultural malaise in regarding to our food, where we're having a million of us a year dying from diet-related disease, we do have to move towards sort of more whole foods that our bodies just, you know, they aren't really assimilated to anymore. And so we have to move sort of slowly and with consideration.
So at the end of this project, you came to the conclusion that you are less concerned about the food you're giving your family than you might have been before. Of course, you're able to produce, given that you have a working farm, a significant portion of the food your family consumes. For people who have other kinds of jobs, what do you suggest for making sure what they're feeding their families is safe?
Yeah, I you know, it was sort of interesting to me, though, that I came to that conclusion. I think part of that was just sort of gaining this awareness of sort of bacteria and its relationship to the human body. And it's sort of like when you get to know something, you fear it a little bit less.
Yeah.
But, you know, more specific to your question, I think, you know, the first thing I would do if, you know, let's say I lived in Dallas or in an urban environment where I didn't have the advantages I enjoy in relation to this incredible access I have to these foods. You know, I would, first of all, really limit my intake of processed foods because processed foods are not really supplying your body with the sort of any of the beneficial enzymes and bacteria that you need. And they're sort of subtly changing the microbiota of your body, the terrain of your body, so that it's going to be more susceptible. You're not going to have good exposure. I would be looking for fermented foods, and most people who live in an urban environment can still find, you know, yogurt and other fermented foods like sauerkraut. You want to look for stuff that hasn't been pasteurized, but kombucha, any of those sort of highly acidic fermented foods, cheese, that haven't been cooked to death, are really a step in the right direction. You know, the things I would avoid, again, would be the processed foods. And personally, you know, coming out of this book, the only thing that I know that I will never eat again in my life is a hamburger from either a fast food joint or from, you know, sort of a wholesale type of buying club where, or any of those sort of frozen preformed hamburger patties. I'm just not going to touch them. I'm not willing to go there.
Is it possible in this country to make the food supply affordable that is not processed heavily?
You know, that's a great question. The issue of affordability is a really, really big issue. And I don't want to sound tone deaf to that issue because, you know, clearly, particularly in economic times like we have right now, it seems particularly sort of poignant. But I think we also have to start acknowledging the true cost of the food that sort of seems so cheap to us at the grocery store. You know, the average American family spends about 9% of its income on food. That is historically low. But, of course, at the same time, we're spending more on healthcare than ever before. And as we, you know, are learning, you know, unfortunately, every year, you know, we really can't have faith in the safety of our food, whether you're talking about sort of short-term illness or long-term illness. So I guess, you know, I am a big advocate for people really having, you know, sort of a hard sort of sit down and think about, you know, where they want to prioritize their spending in their lives. And I recognize that in some cases it's simply not possible. And you have to make choices within the framework of your ability to afford. But I think in other cases it is possible sometimes to shift our priorities a little bit and acknowledge that, you know, this is something that we're putting into our bodies. I mean, this is probably the most important life-giving commerce that we're going to engage in. And so perhaps we need to respect it, in a way that's sort of equivalent to how important it is.
I'm assuming that you've always had a pretty healthy lifestyle, but have you changed at all the way you cook food or the temperature to which you heat things?
You know, I haven't really, but only because I am so fortunate to have access to food that I don't, I don't have those sort of same concerns about where it came from. I know where it came from. I know the conditions it was produced in. If we don't produce it here on our farm, we are, you know, we sort of live in this sort of hotbed of, regional food. And so there's a lot of food being produced in this region and a lot of regional food commerce. So I have that incredible luxury. Now, if I did not have that luxury, I think there's no question that I would be paying much more attention to the preparation of my food.
The new book by farmer and writer Ben Hewitt is called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. Ben, it's been a really interesting conversation this hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.